Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio, and today we bring you a special edition of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. On this first day of Passover, as we head into the Easter weekend, we look at the prospects for peace in the Promised Land and for an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As we bring you highlights from a public forum held last Sunday in Wausau, a forum that featured a panel of experts and opinion makers, Neil Lewis, Rabbi Dan Danson, Elaine Streit, John Visti, Jeff Lee, and Tracy Feldman, a singer-songwriter from Stevens Point.
I'd bring these flowers home when I was young. They'd shine at our table each night like the afternoon sun. But our foundation started to shake our trust like a window so sharp when it breaks. And compassion could be a mistake, can't forget what's been done. But I remember once we played ball running over the stones. From the houses that fell where that night the tank shells had flown. None of us wanted to lose, but the weeds by the fence never choose on which side they'll grow. It is all that they know. I brought you these flowers from the fence by the soccer field. Now the plants get mowed down on one side before they can bloom. From my pockets, the hope I have saved, I'll shake a few seeds on your grave and lay down these flowers to dry by the light of the moon. Thanks. Thank you.
Singer-songwriter Tracy Feldman setting the tone for the public forum Peace in the Promised Land, held April 5th at the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau. Tracy recently moved to central Wisconsin, where he took a position as professor of biology at UW-Stevens Point. Before that, in North Carolina and Oklahoma, he organized benefit concerts on behalf of environmental causes and the cause of peace in the Middle East. Tracy Feldman describes himself as an American Jew who is troubled by the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands.
As an American Jew, I grew up hearing about the Holocaust and about how various nations had tried to exterminate the Jews throughout history. We have often been victims of atrocities, and we vowed that it should never happen to us again. And I also remember hearing stories about Israel as a heroic state, one that provided Jews with shelter from persecution, and that the Jewish state was always in peril of being crushed by anti-Jewish Arabs on all sides. I have periodically experienced anti-Semitism from people who make jokes about Jews, who perpetuate negative stereotypes about Jews, or who express fear of Jews and taking power. From accounts in the Bible, it seems like the Jews have never been an especially peaceful people. But Jews are certainly not alone. Violence seems to be a part of the human condition. And too often, people who have been persecuted in the past fall into the trap of persecuting others when conditions change. The more I learned about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, either from talks given by Palestinians and Israelis, or from just talking to people personally, the more I understood that Palestinians were suffering at the hands of the Israeli government. And I learned that Israel, in a position of relatively greater power, has committed atrocities against the Palestinian people for a long time. And the U.S. has helped them do it. I did not understand how violence and denial of human rights could be justified by anyone, regardless of their history.
Panelist Neil Lewis is a professor emeritus, senior lecturer, and former chair of the Department of History at UW-Stevens Point. He has studied at the American University in Cairo, Egypt, at Harvard, and at the University of Michigan, where he concentrated on Middle Eastern studies and Arabic history. He has made hundreds of presentations on those topics to university, state, and community groups, and literary, radio, and television audiences.
One of the things that I feel should be understood about the conflict is that it's basically a struggle conflict between two rival nationalisms for the same rather small plot of land. And this has been a fairly nasty, often ugly struggle that has gone back more than half a century. And unfortunately, one of my dictums on the situation, it applies to other areas as well, but especially the Arab-Israeli conflict, is that everybody keeps score, but nobody counts very well. And, you know, they know very much the violence that was created against them, but kind of forget their own. If there's going to be peace, obviously both sides are going to have to take more responsibility for controlling the extremists in their ranks.
Panelists John Visti and Elaine Streit have each spent more than 20 years in the Middle East, working and living with the Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza. John managed field offices and administered programs for CARE International and Save the Children. Elaine helped administer a U.S.-funded program awarding 8,000 scholarships to needy students at more than 100 private schools in the region. While working in the Middle East, John Visti and Elaine Streit witnessed a deterioration of living conditions in the occupied lands, brought about in part by the decision by Israel to build a wall around the West Bank.
The wall means that many people have been cut off from their neighbors, schools, health clinics, and agricultural land. Farmers, particularly in the northern West Bank, have had their fields and orchards effectively confiscated from them because they no longer have access. Villages have been surrounded by the wall, and it can take hours to make a trip to market, a trip that formerly took minutes. Religiously, both Muslims and Christians have been cut off from the holy city of Jerusalem, unable to visit the sites dear to them without exceptional permits which are impossible to get if you are male and under 45 years of age. This lack of access caused by checkpoints, the wall, and the denial of permits to enter Israel has affected the lives of the Palestinians. They cannot get to work easily. Their kids have trouble getting to school. Commerce is hampered. People from Nablus cannot see relatives in Jerusalem or Hebron, and vice versa. These constraints have had a severe impact on health, income, education, administration, and social and political interactions.
It was tremendously frustrating to work in the West Bank and Gaza. You feel as if you were engaged in a huge Sisyphean enterprise. Enormous efforts is expended building schools, roads, medical facilities, or assisting farmers, only to have buildings destroyed, the roads torn up, and the goods squandered. Some Palestinians have faced the same situation on a personal level, having their homes destroyed multiple times. In one particularly tragic instance when I was working with CARE, we were providing farmers with materials and training so that they could support their families. An enterprising farmer in northern Gaza was growing strawberries, and we provided him with the materials to build a greenhouse to increase his yields. He was able to feed and support his family. A short time after the aid was provided, he was killed in an air raid, along with some of his children. His greenhouses were destroyed, and his fields were designated a no-entry zone. His family could no longer tend to the fields. CARE ended up providing food assistance to the family because they no longer had any source of income. One encountered such stories all too frequently.
Panelist Dan Danson has been the rabbi of Mount Sinai Congregation in Wausau since his ordination from Hebrew Union College in New York in 1988. He is past president of the Midwest Region of Reform Rabbis, as well as a former board member of the Central Conference of American Rabbis and the Wisconsin Council of Rabbis. Rabbi Danson has studied in Israel and visits Israel frequently.
I would argue that there are moments when the Israeli body politic has supported substantive peace efforts, and it is found again and again that its withdrawals and serious moves towards peace have diminished its security. In 1999, after a too long occupation of southern Lebanon, Israel withdrew, but that was followed by very regular rocket attacks that, and again, I think this is illustrative of dynamics that undermine peace. There was a war in 2006, and clearly it was a brutal war, terribly difficult for Lebanese civilians. But that having been said, since 2006, the rocket attacks have virtually stopped. It's always a difficult moment for a peace process when there's been an action that on paper would seem to promote peace that fails and then is followed by a war that actually seems to increase security. It's difficult because clearly it sets in motion the wrong dynamic. The toughest issues facing people who would strive for peace between Israelis and Palestinians is whether or not there's the critical mass among both the Palestinian and Israeli body politic for compromising on the toughest issues. And the toughest issues, at least from where I sit, seem to be two. One is the substantive recognition by the Palestinian body politic of Israel's right to exist as a Jewish nation. And the other difficult issue is the establishment of facts on the ground that would allow for a viable Palestinian state. Until those two things get settled, until there's a critical mass on both sides willing to work towards goals that would allow each side to really recognize a viable political future, we will be left with what we have today.
Facilitator Jeff Lee is an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. He has spent more than 10 years teaching higher education courses in world, European, and Middle Eastern history. Jeff Lee recently returned from an exchange trip to Lebanon with a group of Wausau East High School students, a trip that he says expanded the horizons of the students and also expanded his own horizons.
It was an astounding experience. It was a State Department organized trip that allowed us to take 12 international baccalaureate students from Wausau East over for a 1 week period. The students, of course, knew almost nothing about the region, nothing about Lebanon, nothing about Beirut, where we stayed. I've been teaching Middle Eastern history generally for about a decade, but I think for me it was a remarkable eye opener. You can study somewhere, you can come to understand a place, you can use words like cosmopolitan, which is frequently almost insistently used with regard to Lebanon, but you don't really understand the meaning of those terms until you've seen the way that they are actuated on the ground. This was a great opportunity for our students, and I would encourage everyone to encourage any young people in their lives to spend some time overseas. Not only will you get to know those places, but you certainly will get to understand your own country far better than you ever could by remaining within the borders of your own country.
I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. When we return, Jeff Lee will facilitate the discussion among panelists Neil Lewis, Elaine Streit, John Visti, Tracy Feldman, and Rabbi Dan Danson on the subject of peace in the Promised Land.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Given the current situation, do you see any faction, whether it be the State of Israel or the major political parties within Israel, whether it be the PLO or Hamas, the surrounding Arab states, or indeed even the United States, do you see any of these factions or any of these issues capable of getting what it wants in the short political term without doing vital injury to the other factions involved in the disputes? And any one of you can begin by answering that.
If you don't find on the Israeli side of the issue somebody who's really willing to come to terms with the idea of a truly independent Palestinian state with viable lines of communication, to use the geographer's terminology, then they're not talking about anything that really is going to get off first base. And frankly, I think on the other side, if you find someone who's interested, who's making the case for the Palestinian cause, who thinks that the idea of not having a Jewish state will fly among Israelis, they're just not talking about anything that has any kind of meaning within the Israeli political discussion. So those are the tough questions, and of course, then the devil's in the details, to be sure. But those are two thoughts on that.
I'm wondering if John and Elaine, having lived in the Middle East, mm-hmm. What your answer to this question would be. Is there any hope?
My short answer? No. I've become extremely cynical and pessimistic, and I don't see, you know, that not having a Jewish state is not a viable option. And I think that the advancements of the settlements, what's happened to the fragmentation in the West Bank, has made it impossible for a two-state solution.
This is the thing. I don't know whether there's hope or not. I don't see much hope in the short term either. I try to take a longer-term view when I look at these situations and almost any situation that seems intractable in life. But I think we in the U.S. have a large role to play. And from what I've been told, and I haven't done a lot of political advocacy work, from what I've been told, it's very hard to get in the door to talk to Republicans or Democrats about this. So both sides of the aisle are kind of dead set against listening to people about this issue. I think if this issue were more popular, were more well supported amongst people in the U.S., the populace of the U.S., I actually think that there would be some hope then.
I tend to agree with Tracy on this. I've for a long time been kind of a short-term pessimist, long-term optimist, which, again, is making me nervous the older I become, because I might not be around to actually see it. The simple solution, and of course simple solutions won't work, but the simple solution would be for each of the major parties, including the United States, to control their own extremists and crazies. And obviously, that is very difficult to do. One of the scary things that's developed rather negatively in the last decade and a half, two decades, is the power of American Christians, fundamentalists, who are determined that this is the fulfillment of biblical prophecies, and therefore, you know, bring on Armageddon. They see Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecies. And it's a kind of a strange relationship, because hardline Israelis often link up with these hardline American Christians together in a kind of strange alliance. Although the fate for Jews, according to themes of rapture and whatnot, are not exactly positive, because most of them who will be allowed to live will convert to Christianity, which is not what most Jews are planning to do, and the rest are consigned to just really horrible, graphic fates. And, you know, unfortunately, that particular strange Christian group has a lot of impact on U.S. policy, and it'd be nice if we could control our crazies as at least a start in moving in the right direction.
I think I certainly share the short-term pessimism that most people on this panel have expressed. But I think if there is one concrete thing that we could all do, it would actually be to write to our congressmen and to our senators and to implore that they take a more balanced look at the Middle East, that they look with at least a bit more sympathy and understanding to the Palestinian side. And then I think that the way Congress has viewed and has actually, Congress appropriates funds. Congress appropriates the budget. So whether it's for military for the Israelis or whether it's for faculty development scholarships for Palestinians, that's appropriated by Congress. And if you want to bring balance to the Middle East, it's only going to happen through Congress. They're the crazies that we actually need to influence.
So to summarize, what we have is a political moment wherein politics within the state of Israel dictate that to be a major player in the Knesset, the parliament or Congress, to perhaps have a shot at the prime ministership, you have to have a party that is taking a hardline approach against Palestinian violence. On the Palestinian side, you have this struggle, perhaps for the hearts and minds of the Palestinians, between the PLO and Hamas. And one of the reasons that Hamas has come to the forefront is not merely its religious message, but because it claims to be the more consistent fighter for Palestinian interests, and again, fighting in violent anti-Israeli terms. You've got a variety of states within the region who are looking after their own interest, and then you have the United States sitting, hovering a bit above the whole thing, involved in various ways, with an American public that demands that the U.S. remain involved in this crisis and holding it to some degree responsible for finding a solution. What are your hopes for the current American administration? There's a lot of buzz. There's talk of this Obama factor. There's this idea that Obama is not only popular on the streets of the United States and Western Europe, but throughout the Middle East, and that this might be a moment where the United States can push the political players within the Middle East towards some kind of a solution. How would you envision that ideally? What would you like to see the United States do? And then second, do you think the United States will actually attempt what you would suggest?
My hope to answer your question, Jeff, about the Obama administration would be that Obama, whether directly himself or through the person of Hillary Clinton, could in fact tell the Israelis that they must withdraw from their settlements in the West Bank, and certainly, certainly cease building new ones. And that has not happened. I don't know if it will happen, but I would certainly love to see them start with that one.
Yeah, Tracy.
I don't know what changes I could expect from this administration. I don't know. I hope for changes, but I'm not sure what I can expect.
Neil, would you like to add a few words?
There's an old Athenian maxim that goes, the strong do what they will, and the weak suffer what they must, which is pretty cold, but unfortunately much of history seems to affirm that. I would like to add the wise maybe try to do what they can, because obviously sometimes strength does not necessarily lead to good ends. And I think, for example, that the pro-Israeli lobby is too strong for the good of Israel and the good of the United States.
Dan, do you have a response to Neil?
I would make the case the ability of both sides to make the wrong choices in the situation or to have groups within them who do things that effectively make the wrong choices for everybody seems to be unlimited. That's where the despair comes from.
You're listening to Peace in the Promised Land, a special edition of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, celebrating the Week of the Young Child, April 19th through 25th. WECA pictures a future where all young children receive high-quality child care. More information at wisconsinearlychildhood.org.
I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this first day of Passover, as we head into the Easter weekend, you're listening to a special presentation of Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, the public forum Peace in the Promised Land, recorded April 5th at the First Universalist Unitarian Church in Wausau, with the panelists Jeff Lee, Neil Lewis, John Visti, Elaine Streit, Tracy Feldman, and Rabbi Dan Danson.
Jeff Lee now is going to get some questions from the audience, and we'll get responses from our panelists.
Is there enough physical land to accommodate everybody in a peaceful solution? Never mind politics, just the physical area.
John or Elaine, do you want to start with this?
There's not a friend of mine who's a scientist, biologist, had done an environmental study of greater historical Palestine and concluded that there's not enough land to support the people that are there right now. So it's very difficult. But I think that, you know, the right of return, this was a sticking point in a number of the negotiations that have gone on. What most Palestinians say is that they want to have the right of return, and yet they recognize that most people actually would not come back. Olmert just wrote an article in the New York Review of Books in November, December, where he said that a final peace settlement would require all of, you know, to give, if for Israel to give back the entire, you know, West Bank and Gaza back to 67 borders, including parts of East Jerusalem. So clearly he was feeling that there was enough land.
Rabbi Dan, you...
Again, this is where the devil in the details comes through. I mean, the water issues in Israel are, you know, enormously difficult, period. You know, if to Jewish ears, when you say the right of return of Palestinians to Israel, it is heard by secular as well as religious Israelis as the end of the Jewish state. That's how that's heard. If you ask Jews about the deal breaker at Camp David, that's what they talk about. That's why on the substantive issues, that's the question. Can you come to consensus between Israelis and Palestinians on the fundamental issues that they consider the deal breakers and that they consider such deal breakers, they're willing to still fight a war over it?
Anyone else?
Do we have any more questions from the floor? Israel were to say, okay, you know, we'll make our borders back to the, you know, green line, the 1948, 1949 borders. Do you panelists think that that would reduce the security problems in the sense that Palestinians would say, okay, we've been given what we asked for, or do you feel that Israel would be more threatened because it would have fewer barriers?
Who wants to pick up on that? Neil, do you have any observations?
Well, one of the things is that when we talk about security, we also have to recognize that weapons technology has gotten to the point that a few miles doesn't really give you that much protection. Peace gives better protection than geographical boundaries. And I personally think that for the two-state solution to work would really require the Israelis to draw back behind the green line. That would be a major concession. And yet I think that that would be welcome to both most Israelis and most Palestinians. Now, would that mean total peace, quiet, no violence? Obviously not. It seems that people, and it's apparently hardwired into our DNA, and even the studies of chimpanzees show that they had similar problems, except for the bonobos who solved their problems through sex rather than violence, which is, and I'm not advocating that necessarily, but it's apparently hardwired into our primate behavior. My kind of short-term pessimism, long-term optimism was given a little bit of support by the fact that peace finally broke out in North Ireland. And there also, you had kind of differences with class struggles by, you know, various nationalism, but made worse by religious convictions that our side's right, their side's wrong. I would like to see George Mitchell really be given a free hand to see what he might be able to accomplish. It would not be easy. And yet, I think that most Palestinians, most Israelis would welcome that kind of push by the United States.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I just want to clarify the question. I don't think anyone is talking about the Israelis moving back to their 48, 49 borders. We're talking about 67, so 67 is a much more definitive state for Israel than 48 was.
Sure, the violence wouldn't stop right away. And I think that it would be tempting to think that if Israel gave the Palestinians what they want, you know, that everything would magically stop and be back to what it was. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it's the people have been subjugated for so long, and there's been so much history behind it. I think it would be really hard. But I do think that it would stop eventually.
Jeff, you want to ask another question?
Hi, I was just wondering if anybody on the panel could touch on the Iranian influence in the region, particularly their support for Hamas and Hezbollah and their try to develop a nuclear weapon.
Neil, why don't you start with that?
Okay. I don't want to be kind of incurably naive, but I think the supposed danger and threat from Iran is kind of grossly overdone. And the fact that I'm not privy to information, and I suspect they're probably working on some kind of nuclear weapon, but a nuclear weapon is not the same as a nuclear arsenal. There is one Middle Eastern state that has a nuclear arsenal. And that, of course, is Israel. And, you know, the Iranians are not going to do a thing that brings nuclear holocaust upon Iran.
Well, Neil, what we have heard, particularly over the past 8 years, is that Ahmadinejad is crazy, and he can't be trusted. And if he has a nuclear weapon, he might just very well use it, well, whether or not if it's in his rational best interest or not.
Sure. But remember who was in charge of U.S. policy during that same period? Were you comfortable with that? I think that, and many people don't have any higher regard for Ahmadinejad in Iran than Americans have now for George Bush. Let's get past that. And both Bush and Ahmadinejad love the constant back and forth and, you know, trading insults and things like that that really didn't do any good for either nation, but it you know, kept getting them headlines and things like that.
Dan, how much is Ahmadinejad feared in Israel, and what kind of a complicating factor is Iran to the whole equation?
Iran is of enormous concern to Israelis. You see a lot in the Israeli press about Iran. Neil raises all sorts of good questions about seeing subtleties and complexities to the situation. And I don't know Iranian civics, but I gather the presidency, he's the president. In lots of countries, the presidency is a fairly weak office. And I know I've seen things that say, keep in mind, he's hardly the whole government. So it's important to remember subtleties and keep your eye on that. That having been said, one nuclear bomb in Tel Aviv, and that's the end of Israel. So Israelis are wary of that as security. I mean, in Israel, it will come back to security again and again and again. That is, you know, we talk about right and left within American politics, and usually we're talking about economics, though more and more we're also talking about culture. But in Israeli politics, you're talking about security issues.
If I wanted to be elected to the Congress of the United States today and voice some of the concerns that we in the audience have and you on the panel all seem to have, I might have a difficult time getting elected if I say anything anti-Israeli because it might be labeled anti-Semite.
Who wants to jump in here?
I'll take a stab at it. That anti-Semitism, along with all the other isms I'd mentioned, was a root cause of the development of Zionism. And it obviously did exist, still exists, and is a major problem. And actually, one of the unfortunate things that happened is that many Arabs, many Muslims have developed a strong sense of anti-Semitism with kind of the old cartoons and caricatures, but clearly this is something that can also be educated against. And one of the things that has happened is that too many Zionists will imply and sometimes absolutely explicitly state that if somebody criticizes Israel who is a Gentile, then it must be anti-Semitism. And on the other hand, as Tracy has kind of indicated, Jews who speak out against Israeli policies can also be subjected to the charge that this is Jewish self-hatred. And of course, then the Zionists have to answer no substantive problems at all because they've dismissed all discussion against it. But this is dangerous because every human institution must be open to criticism. And my favorite quotation from the British military historian Basil Liddell Hart was that unless we are honest about our past and critical of our present, the chances of improving our future are 100 to 1. And I think this is about as true as any such aphorism can be. And yet we've even in recent times experienced where, you know, there were a lot of Americans in the last 8 years, particularly around 2003, who were not particularly interested in being honest about our past. And certainly you shouldn't be critical of our present. And yet if you are not, then the chances of falling into major disasters is very clear.
Well, a pretty good indicator is that if you look at the Israeli political press, you'll see it's an enormously lively press. There is lots and lots and lots of internal self-criticism going on within Israel. There always has been. Whatever Jews do is inherently a reprehensible act. I mean, in some sense, that becomes a definition of anti-Semitism. When it's objective, when it's criticizing policies, when it's using measures that are used universally across the board by the person doing the criticism, then I think criticisms of Israel are more than fair game.
Rabbi Dan Danson and Dr. Neil Lewis. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll conclude our special Route 51 presentation of the public forum Peace in the Promised Land after these short messages.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Why don't we take one more?
This is the last question. I'd like to ask Aleen and John for a kind of a personal question. What are you up to today? Are you still involved in this field of endeavor? If not, did you burn out?
It was a brilliant question. And yes, we did burn out. We actually have spent 25 and 20 years respectively in the Middle East because we lived in Egypt also. I lived in Egypt for 15 years, John for 9. But the last 7 years, the 7 years we spent in West Bank and Gaza, and by the way, we were actually living in Israel. We were living north of Tel Aviv for 4 years. So we have lived on both sides. But We were just absolutely overwhelmed emotionally. I mean, to live north of Tel Aviv, to drive to Ramallah or East Jerusalem every day to work, not only was the commute physically onerous, but the transition that we made from living in what I can only call la-la land in comparison to what we saw when we went through the checkpoints and were on the Palestinian side, it was brutal, and to go through that transition twice every day and to do it for 7 years was, you know, it was, we were exhausted, emotionally exhausted, so we have been lying fallow in the North Woods, taking walks and looking at turtles and deer and feeding the birds, and really kind of relieved to have all of that over there. But having said that, You can't leave it behind you, and you get corralled into things like this, and you have to think again about what, you know, about your experience and how you want to relate it and what you want to relate about it. And I would absolutely encourage young people, they don't all have to go to Israel, Palestine. Egypt is nice. You know, Jordan, Lebanon, the rest of the world. I think doing development work, working for non-governmental organizations is a fabulous way to make a living. I also highly recommend raising children overseas because they grow up knowing about other people and other cultures, maybe even learning other languages. And the American international schools are fabulous, so I recommend it as a way of life. Thank you for asking that question.
And what I'd like to do is conclude by asking all of our panelists, I want you to keep this real brief. I know this is a challenge to all of you, but if you could give me an answer that's about a minute or so, What do you think the best hope for peace between Israelis and Palestinians in the next 10 years, say, where do you think that best hope lies? And Neil, why don't we start with you and then we'll go down the line.
I think maybe the last best hope in this respect is how President Obama conducts his foreign policy, because he's obviously under lots of pressure. And yet, if he does not take a strong position on this and simply allow the situation to deteriorate, then the United States' interests will not be served, nor will the interests of Palestinians and Israelis as well. You know, the United States, I think, is going to have to put some pressure upon Israel to make concessions that would make the two-state solution viable and peace a genuine possibility. I don't know if he'll be able to do it. I don't know if he's willing to do it, but I think that would be necessary.
Elaine, as briefly as possible, what do you think the best hope for peace in the next 10 years is?
I think writing to your congressman and congresswomen, like I said earlier, to try to, you know, impress upon them the fact that they need to have a more balanced approach towards the Middle East.
John?
I think it lies with courageous leadership everywhere, and we have to break the stereotypes. We have to stop using terms like terrorism, Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, Israelis. I mean, all of these things, people have these set stereotypical views about people, and people are diverse and have many opinions, and we are just simply perpetuating the hatred on all sides by the way we're dealing with it. And I think only through some leadership that starts questioning those stereotypes can we have peace.
Tracy, our best hope for peace in the next 10 years.
I think that it has to do with all of the things that everyone else has said, but also educating yourselves, educating all of us. The more we can educate ourselves, the more we can have dialogues with other people who may think differently than we do, who are from different backgrounds from us. I think all of these things are really important and really necessary. And I think from our perspective, I think from the U.S. perspective, because I'm trying to make change over there from here, and so going over there would be another option, and I've been thinking about that for a while, but I haven't gotten there yet, but I'd like to.
And Rabbi Dan, our best hope for peace in the next 10 years.
Well, I think two things come to mind. One is to remember that the people who live in the historic land of Israel, Palestine, whatever moniker you want to give it, they're the primary players. And some of the language we sometimes use in these panels is about we have to control, we have to this, we have to... People are independent entities. And people's behavior, the best results come from internal motivation. And the players are the Palestinians and the Israelis. So we should understand that ultimately in the end, that's where most of the moves for peace are going to be made. Do we have a role as Americans to play in it? There are things that we might be able to do to positively influence the situation, and to some degree it's piggybacking on Elaine's comment. I think as Americans it helps for all of us to hold everybody's feet to the fire, to be skeptical of everybody's claims to what their intents are, and to have, insofar as our policy and our actions and our funding interact with folks in Israel and Palestine, to at least be clear in what we expect and what we see is the fair results to happen, and for us to even, fair, balance, skeptical of what both sides say they'll do, and in a sense demanding of what we at least imagine we would like to see happen.
And so finally, Jeff Lee, as our facilitator, what do you think after having watched this conversation and participated in it?
Well, that is the difficulty of going last. All the good lines have been given. I think you have to understand politics as a marketplace. Often in academia, we're becoming very tired now of the use of business language to describe everything. But looking into politics, without any naivete regarding the power of political institutions to manipulate the public, at the end of the day, they need votes. We're talking about democracies. in part at least, if we're talking about the United States, we're talking about Israel, or we're talking about the Palestinian Authority. One of the sources of Hamas power is the fact that they won the last Palestinian elections. If the public responds to extremist messages or the language of violence or the language of us versus them, if that's what the public responds to, that's what the public's going to get. And so what you and I and everyone involved on every angle of this has to do is refuse those messages. Show that we're not receptive to that. Until we do that, then we get the governments we deserve.
Jeff Lee, Neil Lewis, John Visti, Elaine Streit, Tracy Feldman, Rabbi Dan Danson, a round of applause for our panelists, please. That concludes our forum on peace in the Promised Land. Thanks again to the First Universalist Unitarian Church and the Reverend Paul Beckel, to Jim Moss of the Peace Action Task Force, and to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to all of our panelists, and thanks especially to all of you for being a good and patient audience. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Until next time, take care and be well. Next Thursday, April 16th at 5 p.m., Democratic Congressman Dave Obie returns to our Wisconsin Public Radio airwaves, live in our Wausau studios, taking your questions and comments on the economy, the budget, and the stimulus package that he helped to write as chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Another special edition of Route 51 next Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our general manager, Rick Ryer. Have a great holiday weekend. Until next week, be well. We're heading out of town.